impenetrable language, all by the chairman's own design. It is, in a word, greenspeak.
In the last year or so, I've become a very big fan of a television program called Doctor Who.
Nerds!
It's exciting. You know, I like sci-fi. I like sci-fi in space. I like aliens and ships and stories and adventures. So Doctor Who has most of what I'm looking for. One thing that I also like about science fiction is plausibility. Right? Like, I like to at least think that this could make sense. And sometimes Doctor Who, in that respect, leaves me longing for a little bit more. One of my frustrations, now, don't get me wrong, I love Doctor Who. One of my frustrations is that sometimes, like, they'll get into these jams. And at the beginning of the show, I'll say, oh, how are they going to get out of this one? And I know they're going to get out of it. But when they finally do get out of it, I'm not always satisfied with the explanation of how they got out of it. In fact, sometimes the Doctor will even explain away how he manages to solve these problems and get out of these jams with the phrase wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey. Now, that's more jargon than garbly-gook, but I have to admit it leaves me feeling kind of unsatisfied, you know, in my desire for realistic science fiction. Now, this is, to be fair, this is part of the show. The Doctor is a Time Lord. He's an alien. He's been alive for 900 years. He is wise beyond human comprehension. And I think that as the audience, and certainly this is also true for his companions, perhaps we're not supposed to understand how he figures everything out. But still, it leaves me longing for explanation. Like here's an example of what I'm talking about. He, quote from a recent episode, Doctor Who, currently being played by Matt Smith, says, "There's a good chance that if we can reverse the polarity on this lithium crystal, then the magnetic vortex will suck the Daleks into a different time-space continuum and the planet will be saved. Has anyone got a hatpin?" Unquote. Now, the truth is, I'm just being nitpicky here. I'm going to continue to watch Doctor Who. And this kind of language is fine for a wise beyond our comprehension, fictional, time-traveling action hero. But I think it should be avoided by someone if their job is to, say, I don't know, serve as the chairman of one of the most powerful financial organizations in the entire world, which, although highly secretive, has a dramatic impact on the lives of average people through its manipulation of discount rates and interest rates, Federal Reserve, I'm talking about, specifically Alan Greenspan. If I had a job that important, I would want to make sure that I was speaking in clear language that the people that I serve could certainly understand. Of course, unless I was up to something.
In public, Greenspan was inscrutable whenever Congress asked about interest rates. He resorted to an indecipherable Delphic dialect known as Fed speak.
I would engage in some form of syntax destruction, which sounded as though I were answering the question, but in fact had not.
We showed him a tape of him at a hearing.
Modest preemptive actions can obviate the need of more drastic actions at a later date, and that could destabilize the economy. Very profound.
Very profound. Impenetrably profound. And so you worked on these, right?
Oh, of course.
You worked on making it even more. But what would often happen is you'd get two newspapers with opposing headlines coming out of the same hearing.
I succeeded.
Everybody, this is Brett, and today we're going to resume our series on doublespeak, discovering doublespeak. Now, at this point, even though it's been a while, we have looked at three different types of doublespeak. Well, two official types of doublespeak. and one that I added. So I just thought, if you haven't heard those shows, they're definitely within the last 10 or 12 most recent episodes of School Sucks Podcast, so go back and check them out. But this is what we covered. First, the euphemism. Words and phrases that attempt to soften or hide or distort reality by putting whatever is being described into a better light, making it look less threatening, less urgent, less offensive. To that, I added the malphemism or the dysphemism, which is just the opposite. Things that are words that are chosen to mislead by being intentionally harsh, make things look worse than they actually are. The third installment, Mark Stevens joined me, and we talked about jargon, specifically in the form of legalese. Now, this is where a certain profession has its own language, and the people who are in the know in that profession use that language to confuse outsiders, lay audiences, using overly complex terms to impress, but usually to confuse. Definitely that's the case with the injustice system anyway. Now, the next type of doublespeak is usually referred to as gobbledygook, but it could also be called bureaucratese, the language of bureaucrats, and I think we could even get away with calling it circumlocution. And what this is, it's similar to jargon, but maybe not so much using sophisticated, unfamiliar words as using words that most people know. They might be, you know, 3-4-syllable words, but words that are pretty common, but arranging them in these convoluted sentences designed to confuse the audience and obfuscate the real issue. Now, the first thing I want to talk about, I think, might help provide a better understanding of what gobbledygook or circumlocution or bureaucratese is, and what it does, and why it's used. There's something that I find myself discussing pretty frequently, pretty much every time I teach one of these SAT classes, specifically when I'm working on the critical reading part of the test, and that's where you have to like read some passages and then answer questions about those passages. This is a phenomenon that I think is pretty common for students, pretty common for adults. It's happened to me during audiobooks. So it's not even just specific to reading, but I call it sleep reading. Now, the thing with the SATs, especially the critical reading section, is there's a lot of unfamiliar vocabulary. And that's intentional. I mean, there's going to be words that, you know, the average 11th or 12th grader does not know. There's going to be words that I don't know. There's going to be words that you don't know, whoever you are. And there's going to be words that high school English teachers and college English professors don't know that appear as vocabulary words in this part of the SAT. Now, are there ways to figure out, using either context clues or roots, to get an idea of what these unfamiliar words mean? Yeah, a lot of the time. And remember, too, that the SAT is multiple choice. So, you know, there's ways around the unfamiliarity with certain words. But there is something that happens, because the vocabulary isn't just like, what does this word mean, or, you know, figure out which word should go in the blank in this sentence. These passages that the students read have a lot of unfamiliar vocabulary in them as well. Now, this phenomenon that I started talking about, I call sleep reading. And I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but from the feedback I've gotten from students, it seems pretty common. When we're reading a passage, and maybe we're not reading as actively as we could, you know, we're just kind of reading it to get through it, we might cross over some unfamiliar word, and then we go into sleep reading mode when we go past that word, but then we continue to move our eyes down, you know, across the lines and down the page, but we really aren't comprehending what's going on after we stumbled or tripped over that unfamiliar word or phrase or term. Now, maybe you already know what I mean, but maybe you don't. So let's say, like I said, it didn't have to be reading. So let's say you're listening to this podcast and I'm in the middle of explaining something. Now, you're smart, you're paying attention, you're listening actively. But then right in the middle of a sentence, I stop and I just go, snakes on a plane, snakes on a plane. Oh shit, snakes on a plane. And then I go right back to whatever I was saying. Now, it's not like as soon as I resume making sense and I go back to what I was saying that you're going to be like right there with me. No, I'm going to continue talking and you're going to be like, what the hell did he just do there? Why did he do that? Snakes on the plane, like the movie? And I've lost you. And you're smart and you were paying attention, right? So I think the way this works was we come across something, we don't know what it means, and then we have to start saying, okay, I didn't know what that meant, I didn't know what that meant, and we're kind of thinking about what that means, or that we didn't know what it means, but our eyes continue to move along through the reading. And that's sleep reading. So I always tell people that they need to be aware, they need to, you know, recognize when they don't know the meaning of a word, because I think, you know, especially when you're on the SAT and you're working against the clock and you're worried about running out of time, you just want to keep going. But, you know, stop, use, I give them some strategies for sort of decoding unfamiliar language that they encounter in that part of the test. But it happens, I think it happens to all of us. Write me and tell me if I'm wrong. Sometimes it has to do with just not being focused enough. But if someone starts, if we're listening to something or reading something and it goes over our head, if we don't check ourselves and say, okay, I either need to look up a word or try to make some meaning based on context clues out of that word, it's very easy to kind of just get lost after that point. It's similar to that whole phenomenon of, like, once you know what a word means, you start hearing it more often, right? Like, before, you were just kind of tuning it out. Do you know about that, too? Does that happen to you? That happens to me. Write me and tell me if I'm wrong about that, too. Facebook. School Sucks Facebook page. Now, if you agree with me about what we've said so far, and you've experienced this, you understand how easy it is for this to happen by accident, right? Just a matter of not being tuned in enough to what you're reading or what you're listening to, or being interested enough or listening or reading actively enough. People can use this to intentionally throw people off, intentionally lose people, intentionally confuse people. So essentially what gobbledygook is it is a speaker casting a spell, so to speak, on a listener, where there's an arrangement of words in such a way where the speaker can continue talking, but the listener has to stop and really work hard to process, to make sense of whatever the speaker just said. It doesn't have to be snakes on a plane. It doesn't have to be crazy. It doesn't even have to be unfamiliar words. It just has to be organized in such a way that it throws the listener for enough of a loop that they lose the speaker. So let's look at a few more examples. These are all courtesy of Mr. Greenspan. Number one, this is from 2001. The members of the Board of Governors and the Reserve Bank presidents foresee an implicit strengthening of activity after the current rebalancing is over, although the central tendency of their individual forecast for real GDP still shows a substantial slowdown on balance for the year as a whole. Not one unfamiliar word in there. Here's another one. Risk takers have been encouraged by a perceived increase in economic stability to reach out to more distant time horizons. But long periods of relative stability often engender unrealistic expectation of its permanence and at times may lead to financial excess and economic stress. Now, while some apologist types have argued that Fed speak, this sort of vague communication, is necessary to prevent, traders from overreacting to things that the Fed chairman says and causing dramatic fluctuations in the market, it really seems to be about making people who are not inside the Federal Reserve feel as if economics is something that is just beyond their understanding. But while Fed speak or this circumlocution in general may be difficult to decode, it doesn't have to be that difficult to identify. So let's say you're 15 or 16 years old, a little younger, a little older, whatever. How do you know? Well, most adults speak. In fact, almost all adults speak at a level that you can understand. Maybe with the exception of discussion about some more specialized field or industry, but I think that falls more into jargon. And why are they talking to you about it anyway? If somebody is talking to you, their goal should be communication with you. So if you're really listening to somebody and you have absolutely no idea what they're talking about, that speaker is either not a good communicator or that speaker is trying to deliberately confuse the listeners. And this has nothing to do with intelligence, in my opinion. I think some people speak in a manner that is designed to give them the upper hand in a conversation, as if to subtly suggest that they are more intelligent than you, that they are more intelligent than the listener. And from there, I think we can also understand how this type of doublespeak also became known as bureaucratese, where a lot of these bureaucrats are, you know, trying to communicate to people who are bothering them by, like, being inquisitive. Hey, there's no way you could understand all of the things that I have to deal with. My job is so complex and beyond the understanding of a layperson, so you should just shut up. I'm smarter than you. I know more than you. Shut up. You're annoying me. I don't know if you've ever dealt with a bureaucrat and gotten that kind of a feeling. I have. So, before we move on, let's just talk about identification. I mentioned that, and then I kind of went off on a tangent there. But the identification of gobbledygook, circumlocution, and bureaucratese, in my opinion, comes down to sentence structure. Now, there are three types of sentences that good communicators use, and they vary them in their writing and speaking, when trying to communicate with other people. There are simple sentences, there are compound sentences, and there are complex sentences. Now, a simple sentence, a subject does a verb, period. This airplane, subject, is verb, infested with snakes, period. That's a simple sentence. Now, a sentence becomes compound when there are two independent clauses joined by a connector like and or but, or even so. Like, for example, there are snakes on this motherfucking plane, so I am getting off. Period. Sentences become complex when one clause is independent, which means it can function as its own sentence, and one clause is dependent, which means it needs something else to be a complete sentence. For example, although there are snakes on this plane, I am confident that Samuel Jackson will know what to do. Period. Samuel Jackson, he's the man. He never needed a sonic screwdriver for any jam that he was ever in. So anyway, those are three types of sentences. And when you hear people spitting out these massively complex and convoluted sentences that seem never-ending, well, I would say that that's an indicator that they are trying to speak in a way that is designed to confuse people. Now, because this type of doublespeak masquerades as sophisticated communication, you won't hear politicians doing it too much, since politicians aren't about sophistication. They're about speaking to adults like they're 11-year-olds. But politicians do have a version of it, and it kind of works like this. And if you watch these debates, you'll see people like Romney and Gingrich trying to pull this trick. When they're talking about foreign policy issues and economic issues, they'll throw in some terminology that I'm guessing they think is over the heads of the people in that audience, which is usually, if you've seen and heard those audiences, those heads are not too high. But then they will just change their tone. They'll change their inflection at the end of what they're saying to get applause, right? So you can tell when applause is coming from a crowd that isn't actively listening just by the way the politician changes his tone. And they'll actually build, they must be trained in how to do this. They'll like build towards a crescendo, and now it's time for you to clap like seals. And this is particularly effective in these Republican debates anyway, if the content of that crescendo is something about how America has never done anything wrong, and they hate us for our freedom, and we stand for freedom, and USA, best country in the world, that kind of thing. Which is really just a result of knowing your audience is dumb. I could probably produce an example of that. This is actually the opening of the New School Sucks video, The Magic of Pronouns. Go to YouTube and check that out, please.
Attacked because of our actions. We were attacked, as Newt talked about, because we have a civilization that is antithetical to the civilization of the jihadist. And they want to kill us because of who we are and what we stand for. And we stand for American exceptionalism. We stand for freedom and opportunity for everybody around the world. And I am not ashamed to do that.
30 seconds, Mr. Paul.
But again, this is not true gobbledygook. This is more just like a simple trick of tone and inflection, not to like massively insult the intelligence of these Republican debate audiences. But it's kind of like you can get away with saying really mean things to your cat if you do so in a really nice sounding voice. Trust me, you can. So real gobbledygook is a rhetorical tool, rhetorical trick of the intellectuals. So let's go back to the master. Alan Greenspan, former chairman of the Federal Reserve. By the way, the woman who is interviewing him in this clip, not exactly throwing the hard balls. Not exactly bringing the heat with these questions. I think you're going to see what I mean.
You know what's amazing to me is not only are you dealing with these crises, I mean, and it's not just 1987, you've got long-term capital management collapse, and then you've got the SNL bailout, and then you've got Mexico, you've got Russia. I mean, all of these important economic events, you are overseeing the most important institution and leading things. And then, not only are you dealing with these crises, but then you've got to convey what's going on to people. That means Congress, the president, the media, the public. So what, you come up with Greenspeak?
Otherwise known as FedSpeak.
What is it?
It's a language of purposeful obfuscation to avoid certain questions coming up. You end up with when, say, a congressman asks you a question, and you don't want to say no comment or I won't answer or something like that. So I proceed with four or five sentences which get increasingly obscure. The congressman thinks I answered the question and goes on to the next one.
The role of the Fed, and the Fed, therefore the Fed chairman, is monetary policy and overseeing the banks under their control. That's the role of the Federal Reserve. Well, he overplayed it always. First of all, he spoke in terms that the ordinary citizen and ordinary person, when they listened to him, could not understand. My problem was that I was on so many banking committees that I actually started to understand what he was saying. That scared the hell out of me.
I used to go and watch him testify before the House and Senate banking committees, which are not among the intellectual leadership groups of the United States, and about half of these guys would ask him really dumb questions. I was wondering, what could he do? But he would convert the question into something to which you could give an intelligent answer which backed the positions that he'd taken at the Fed itself.
I remember watching some of the hearings and you testifying, and you know, some of the congressmen would say, look, I don't understand what you're talking about, you know, and then I remember one when you rolled your eyes and thought, yeah, I know that you don't understand what I'm talking about. Should people have been more studied about these issues? Should they have known? Or do you think some of these guys were attacking you because they really didn't understand the issues?
No, you got to remember that in large part, for a lot of the congressmen and senators, you're a prop, because the cameras that matter are not the national cameras, but the hometown cameras. And so that what you get is shots of their asking the question. Rarely do you get shots of the answer.